this roadless route takes away the opportunity for people to survive for their family and take and have a sustainable silvicultural industry taking care of our forests in Southeast Alaska.
Congressman Young wins a narrow victory in the House, exempting the Tongass from the roadless rule. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Wrangell citizens succeed in protecting a popular recreation spot from contaminants.
My daughter Natalia was so happy. She said, "Mom, this means that we can go ice skating on Pat's Lake this winter."
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
The U.S. House tonight narrowly passed an amendment to exempt Alaska's national forests from the roadless rule. The measure is now part of the House Agriculture Bill, and Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports on how it got there.
The roadless rule exemption was sponsored by Alaska Congressman Don Young. He says the rule severely curtails logging in the Tongass National Forest.
I'm saying this roadless route takes away the opportunity for people to survive for their family and take and have a sustainable silvicultural industry taking care of our forests in Southeast Alaska.
The vote turned dramatic on the House floor. Young, the most senior member of Congress, paced the chamber with his list, shouting the names of colleagues he needed to get on board. When the vote clock ran to zero, he was losing, but the rolls were held open. "I need four more votes," Young shouted at one point. He got one yay, then another. Republican Representative Ryan Costello of Pennsylvania made a big show of changing his vote from no to yes, looking over at Young to ensure the favor was noted. And then Young had it, 208 to 207.
The amendment is adopted.
Young raised both arms in victory. A few minutes later, he was at the elevator to leave for the night. How did you manage that?
It's what you call kindness. Kindness. I can be nice.
All right, it's enough.
The roadless rule has been a thorn in the side of Alaska's congressional delegation since 2001. Environmental groups and their allies among Southeast Alaska fishermen and business owners say it preserves habitat and protects old-growth trees. The agriculture bill still has a long way to go. The House is expected to vote on the full bill before adjourning for the weekend. Democrats oppose its restrictions on food stamps, and the Senate is writing its own version. Reporting from the Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Meanwhile, a controversial old-growth timber sale in Southeast Alaska is going to court. Conservation groups and a tourism operator are suing the U.S. Forest Service over the Kuyu Island timber sale. The lawsuit was filed on Wednesday in Alaska's federal district court. In 2006, wood from the parcel was approved for export, but the Forest Service received zero bids. Earlier this month, the timber sale went out for bid again, this time with less acreage. The Forest Service removed some of the more sensitive watershed areas. The plaintiffs in the lawsuit allege the Forest Service's environmental analysis is outdated and violates federal environmental protections. They're concerned the logging would damage important salmon habitat and wreck the view, which tour operators rely on. The Forest Service is accepting bids on the Kuyu Island timber sale until June 5th. Wrangell's tribe and city have won a year-long fight to protect a fishing stream and popular recreation site. The state had planned to dispose of tons of lead-contaminated soil at a rock pit near Pat's Creek, but many in the community spoke out against dumping at the site. Legislators took note of those concerns and allocated $5 million to ship the waste entirely off the island. KSTK's June Leffler has the story.
The Wrangell Cooperative Association never budged from its original position. No dumping near Pat's Lake. The tribe looked for alternative sites, extra federal funding, and outside scientific opinion. All options were on the table, but most did not pan out. Then, the tribe reached out to elected officials and met with Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott. And Governor Bill Walker went to bat for the concerned citizens of Wrangell. He requested $5 million to ship the soil off Wrangell Island. Then the Senate and House passed that appropriation in its capital budget. Esther Ashton is the tribal administrator.
I told my children, and my daughter Natalia was so happy. She said, Mom, this means that we can go ice skating on Pat's Lake this winter.
The contaminated soil comes from the old Byford junkyard, where residents dumped dead cars for decades. The lead came from their batteries. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation cleaned up much of the junk and treated the soil with a stabilizing agent. The state agency proposed placing the soil at the rock pit and still says it is a more than safe option for hundreds of years to come. But DEC's director, Jeff Rogers, understands the public's concern.
When you've got a contaminated site in your backyard, it is a passionate local issue. Certainly, we believe the site at Pat's Creek to be environmentally viable and sustainable. That doesn't mean that people want it in their backyard. There is a higher cost option, and the governor supports that higher cost option.
The city also contacted politicians in support of the off-island option. Wrangell's representative in the House, Dan Ortez, voted in favor of the funding during House Finance Committee meetings.
I felt like I was advocating for what I felt to be the majority opinion in Wrangell.
Of course, not everyone in the southeast city wanted this option. Brett Woodbury is a local contractor. He has been working with the Department of Environmental Conservation on the cleanup. He says he's prepared tons of material for the rock pit that he might not be paid for. And work for him and his employees has shut down at times when he could be pursuing other contracts in town. The state is in the early stages of shifting gears for off-island disposal. Officials are unsure exactly where the waste will go, and it may have to find additional funding later. But the state says one thing is for sure. No dumping near Pat's Lake. In Wrangell, I'm June Loeffler.
Still to come, big headaches for tour operators as the summer tourism season ramps up amid a park permit backlog.
I think that we just need the Forest Service to really buckle down and focus on tourism and to plan long term.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. And by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at RavenDayOver.com.
Alaska State Troopers have released the name of a pilot killed in a crash near Whittier. Troopers say the man killed was 31-year-old Brett Andrews of Anchorage. The Rescue Coordination Center late Saturday morning notified troopers that an emergency locator transmitter had been activated in the Whittier area. Crews on RCC and Coast Guard helicopters found the crash site and confirmed the death. A trooper helicopter and members of Alaska Mountain Rescue Group recovered the pilot's body on Sunday morning. It was then released to the state medical examiner. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, is based in Washington. But Sitka Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins wants to see NOAA's Alaska-focused staff, programs, and assets relocated closer to home. House Resolution 8 requests NOAA fully staff the Auk Bay Laboratories located at the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute in Juneau. The resolution also asks for the Alaska Fisheries Science Center director to remain in Juneau. AFSC is currently headquartered in Seattle. Christ Tompkins, one of the resolution sponsors, wants to see Alaska's fisheries management happen on the ground.
Just as I think people get frustrated with decisions being made from Washington, D.C., particularly if those decisions don't incorporate the sort of nuance of a local issue, you can have a similar dynamic. And I think it just makes sense for resources to be managed in the place where those resources exist.
House Resolution 8 passed the House earlier this month by a vote of 36-1. Christ Tompkins calls it ammunition for a larger effort by Alaska's congressional leaders.
We're going going to continue to work with Senator Murkowski's and Sullivan's offices to try to make sure the National Marine Fisheries Service, there's a couple of specific asks that we're going to pursue to basically make sure that the agency follows through with the spirit of this resolution and the work that our congressional delegation is doing.
Alaska's fisheries generate approximately $4.5 billion a year. Southeast Alaska is projected to see upwards of 1 million tourists this year. Many of those visitors will venture into the wilder parts of the Tongass National Forest for a guided hike or bear viewing. And that requires a special use permit from the Forest Service. But as tourism increases and federal budgets shrink, a permitting backlog is growing. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has the story.
Let's just get this out of the way. I did not see a brown bear. But on a recent trip to a remote spot in the Tongass National Forest, that wasn't the point. As our float plane motors away into the water, Dan Kirkwood, a guide with Pack Creek Bear Tours, explains the mission.
We're here because this is an outstanding, cool location that we have the opportunity to explore in the Tongass, and we're really excited about getting access to a new place, and so we want to scope it out.
Hey there.
We walk past a big, broad meadow and rapids that will squirm with salmon when the fish spawn.
Look at that. That's cool.
This is Kirkwood and his guiding partner's first time here. They want to see if it's a good place to bring small tours of up to 5 people, visitors who want to experience brown bear country up close with the safety of a guide.
For us, this is the wilderness. This is a place that's unfamiliar, but this is Main Street. This is their front door. This is their living room. The trails in here have been used for probably centuries.
But to be able to bring people into this bear's house, Kirkwood must first receive what's called a special use permit from the U.S. Forest Service. And he might have a bit of a wait. There's a backlog of well over 6,000 of these permits nationally. In the Tongass specifically, there are dozens of recreation outfits waiting to hear back. Kirkwood wonders how the Forest Service will manage to process all of those, which seem to be piling up.
I think that we just need the Forest Service to really buckle down and focus on tourism and to plan long term.
The reason for the backlog has nothing to do with bears. Wildfires are burning a massive hole in the agency's budget. 20 years ago, wildfires accounted for 16% of the Forest Service's annual funds. In recent times, the number has ballooned to more than half, a phenomenon attributed to longer burning seasons due to climate change.
What that has done is it's taken away money from the Forest Service that they could use, for instance, for recreation.
Patrick Shannon is the director of the Alaska Forest Fund, a nonprofit that helps the Forest Service maintain its lands. Shannon is hopeful that more help is on the way. Congress recently granted the Forest Service the ability to tap into additional emergency funds.
They haven't identified where that other money is going to come from yet, but the first step really is to give them the authority.
That won't happen until 2020. In the meantime, Congress did increase the Forest Service budget for this fiscal year, but it's still too early to tell if it's enough to compensate for the wildfire season to come and how that will shake out for recreation funding.
Here's our plane.
Packing up after scouting out the area, Dan Kirkwood concludes this spot in the Tongass has plenty to offer.
Yeah, we would definitely apply for permits here because even though it's a bit of a long flight for us, it's fabulous bear habitat. The scenery's off the charts.
But he's uncertain how long it'll be before he can show it to tourists. According to a regional Forest Service spokesperson, a special use permit can take up to 2 years. And Kirkwood doesn't see the demand to explore these wilder places slowing down. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
The Alaska Marine Highway System has a new top official. State Transportation Commissioner Mark Lukin on Tuesday appointed Shirley Marquardt as Executive Director of the Ferry System. Marquardt served as mayor of Unalaska, the ferry system's westernmost port. She represented her region on the state's Marine Transportation Advisory Board for more than a decade. She's also worked for seafood processors and a barge line. Marquardt will oversee an initiative to change the system from a state agency to a public corporation. She says that's part of what attracted her to the job.
It's such a different way to look at operating the ferry system, but clearly what we've been doing in the past almost 20 years is not working real well.
The executive director's job is new. It replaces the deputy commissioner of marine transportation, which has been open for about a year. Robert Venables is president of the Marine Transportation Advisory Board. He says Marquardt will bring business experience to the system, as well as what's called the Ferry Reform Project.
She really understands the maritime industry, and she understands the community importance of the marine transportation mission of the Alaska Marine Highway System. And so she's very well-rounded, and I think she's going to bring a great depth of expertise and executive decision-making.
Marquardt will begin her job on June 1st. She'll move to Ketchikan from Anchorage, where she's been the governor's director of boards and commissions. General Manager John Falvey will continue to oversee marine highway operations, as he has for more than a decade.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds, narrowing blood vessels. Clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart. Protect it. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
The U.S. Coast Guard is soliciting feedback on their six new polar icebreakers, which are expected to be training in Arctic waters as soon as 2023. USCG's Commander Kenneth Boda says the plan is to make at least three of the vessels heavy icebreakers equipped to travel through the Arctic and Antarctica. That means they'll have to be polar code compliant.
They're going to be latest technology, you know, current icebreaking technology, which is really neat because they're replacing the Polar Class vessels, which are built in the mid-70s. We have three key performance parameters for these vessels. We need them to break 6 feet of ice at 3 knots. We want them to break 21 feet of ridged ice. The second is an endurance requirement. We need it to operate between 80 and 90 days without refueling. And the third is interoperability.
Currently, most of the Coast Guard's icebreaker fleet has exceeded its work life. The USCG Cutter Healy, a medium icebreaker, is the only one that hasn't yet reached 20 years of service.
You know, she was built for a 30-year service life, delivered to us and commissioned in 2000. So, we're looking ahead at doing a midlife in Healy in the upcoming years to try and extend her life out further.
The Healy is the main Coast Guard vessel that has spent time in Nome's port and would likely be the icebreaker to respond to emergencies in the Arctic, such as oil spills. Commander Boda has previous experience with the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico and says a larger Coast Guard presence during those incidents is key.
If you had an oil spill that lasted, God forbid, you know, over a month, you would need to be able to get ships up there. You need to be able to do command and control, have a vessel that can talk to the other ships that are out there, that can direct cleanup operations.
The other benefits the Coast Guard lists from six new polar icebreakers includes year-round search and rescue capabilities in Alaska, increased data gathering and collaboration with researchers in the Arctic, as well as enforcing marine laws related to fishing. When it comes to how these polar icebreakers will affect fish and marine life, that's not entirely yet known, but the Coast Guard says there won't be significant impacts to biological resources.
Obviously, as these ships get built, we want to get as much feedback as we can from the villages up here, you know, from the communities, and make sure that we're getting you guys something that you need and something that adds value to Alaska.
Commander Boda and USCG hosted public scoping meetings in Kotzebue and Nome last week. They plan to visit Utqiagvik and Anchorage this month as well. Public comment on the draft environmental impact statement for the icebreakers are being accepted through June 29th. In Kiana, in the Northwest Arctic, the community is taking a different approach to helping their young people develop life skills. They're letting them run some things by themselves. Ann Hillman with Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk looks at the youth-created, youth-driven program called Opt In Kiana.
Teenager Robert Sheldon sulks in the back of the small, aging community building in Kiana, a village in the Northwest Arctic. He's doing what many adults in many communities do all the time, sitting through a really boring planning meeting.
Chair for meeting, Alex. Secretary, Skyla, attendance.
12-year-old Alex Mills opens the weekly meeting. The young teens are planning a 2.5-day-long conference for other youth in the region. Robert says he's only there
because there's nothing else to do around town.
The goal of the group is to help young people develop leadership skills and to think about the positive ways they contribute to the community. That's why the group's name is One Positive Thing in Kiana, or Opt-In. As the meeting about the conference logistics plods on, Robert speaks up. Alex asks about one positive thing from the past week, and Robert, despite his professed apathy, responds from his seat at the far edge of the room.
Well, I delivered stove oil. And I was helping a blind, disabled elder bringing their lunch every day.
Robert may say he's only there because there's nothing better to do, but he gives input on the importance of teaching first aid and what the conference hoodies should look like. It seems really minor, but it turns out that allowing teens like Robert to make small decisions can have long-term, large effects. Research shows that when young people are in charge of decision-making processes and have opportunities to contribute to the community in meaningful ways, they're less likely to participate in risky behaviors like drinking or having sex when they're young. They develop into physically and mentally healthier adults who can handle challenges better. Jean Gerhardt-Cyrus is the group's adult mentor. She says getting Robert to participate, even in these little ways, hasn't been easy, which means engaging with him is even more important.
I think every youth has potential. And we do too much of excluding youth who, you know, have behavioral issues, have academic issues, have social issues, whatever. It's hard to gain those skills if you never have the opportunity.
She says Opt-In Kiana is open to any kid who wants to join. And she's seen them all grow over time. Participation varies from kids who only help out occasionally or go to social events to kids who show up at almost every meeting. She says the locally developed, youth-run program goes beyond providing kids necessary social supports and connections. It teaches practical skills.
These youth, I'm really excited to see them as adults because of their experience. So they know about meetings. They know about how to organize things, take responsibility for them, and see a project from start to finish.
Their biggest project is their annual conference. This spring, they hosted their third. The youth decided to feature things like workshops on sewing, being safe in the village, and applying for scholarships. After the meeting ends, Robert wanders down to play air hockey at the new youth center that's open on some weekends and afternoons. His mom, Millie Sheldon, volunteers to chaperone. She says before joining the leadership group and attending a conference in Anchorage, Robert was acting out and making poor choices. Now, things are different.
He is doing a lot better in our community and getting involved more with helping our community members and our elders.
Though things have improved, it doesn't mean he's completely stopped being a surly teenager.
Is he more pleasant to have in your house now?
Oh, yes, he is. Sometimes.
She says he still complains about delivering food to elders when it's negative 50 degrees out. But now, he does it without being asked. For the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Last week, the Chilcat and Chilcoot rivers were flush with little fish scrambling upstream. The hooligan ran in full force, and many other animals came out to enjoy the harvest, including humans. KHNS's Henry Leisha has this story on the annual event and what local scientists are learning about an important fish.
At the mouth of the Chilcoot River, there's a feeding frenzy happening. Birds dip beaks and talons into the water, pulling out small black and silver fish with every swoop. Off in the distance, a raft of sea lions gorges on the scaly bounty of the Lutak Inlet. A couple humans are enjoying the run as well. Zephyr Cincerni wades out in the river barefoot, scooping up Hooligan with a net. He says his net is a bit heavy for harvesting the fish, but he's worked out a system.
What I end up doing is I take it out into the fish and set it on the bottom a little bit, and then I just wait. And they usually end up flowing back and kind of swimming into the net or settling into it, and then I just lift up and out we go.
Cincerni says the run seems a little bit smaller than last year, but in just 20 minutes he can fill 2 5-gallon buckets. That's all he needs. Once Cincerni gets home, he'll smoke, brine, and add spices to the fish. Then he'll vacuum seal and freeze them to enjoy for the rest of the year. Just upstream from Cincerni, a team of researchers from the Chilkoot Indian Association, or CIA for short, are collecting data for a study on Hooligan. Despite their popularity in the Upper Lynn Canal, very little research has been done on Hooligan. Tokchinook Watershed Council's Executive Director Meredith Pokart is involved with the study. She says researchers are still trying to figure out questions about their life cycle.
Do they actually die after they spawn? And also learning a bit more about the age that they return to the river.
Unlike salmon, it is believed that Hooligan return to a stream in their region rather than the exact stream where they spawned. The location they return to depends on a variety of factors.
You usually see a good amount go to Chilkoot, so I think they might prefer Chilkoot, but if the conditions aren't right, then they'll head off and they can go to Skagway.
That's Ted Hart, a fisheries specialist for CIA. His organization started collecting data for Hooligan populations on the Chilkoot River 8 years ago. Last year, CIA secured a grant to expand the scope of their research. With help from Tokchinook Watershed Council, they now collect data from 11 different rivers around the Upper Lynn Canal. For generations, people have subsistence fished for Hooligan, or sock in Tlingit. Hart says the oil from the fish has countless health benefits and has long been a valuable resource for this region.
It's like liquid gold.
He hopes this research will ensure that future generations can depend on this harvest. This year's run was a few days later and smaller than last year's unusually large run of 12 million fish. Initial estimates show that 8.7 million Hooligan came back to the Chilkoot this year. I'm Henry Leisha.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Jenkins and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, June Leffler in Wrangell, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Davis Hovey in Nome, Ann Hillman in Kiana, and Henry Leisha in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state. Seasonal summer routes now available to Cordova, Anchorage, and Valdez. Information available at flyraven.com.
Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.